This episode of The Greenpiece is supported by my friends at Immersion Journeys, an award-winning tour consultant based in New York City and your source for experiential luxury travel to Africa, South Asia, and way beyond. The Immersion Journeys brand has been built on the foundation that more than the sights, it is the experience. Immersion Journeys is also a proud supporter of Sabi Sabi Private Game Reserve. Immersion Journeys focuses on conscious luxury with an emphasis on positive community and conservation impact through travel. Their deep partnerships with select lodge groups such as Sabi Sabi Private Game Reserve, their selection of professional safari guides and creative trip itineraries provides their guests with unique experiences bar none. For more information, please contact Immersion Journeys on telephone number 917-686-2620 or check out their website at www.immersionjourneys.com. That's immersionjourneys.com. You can also drop them an email at info@immersionjourneys.com. Thanks for tuning into The Greenpiece, that's spelt P-I-E-C-E. I'm Warren Green, your host and one of the storytellers of this weekly podcast, where I'll be telling campfire stories about sustainable safaris, misadventures, and travel tales from around the world. I have a number of interesting people, including safari guides, conservationists, lodge managers, and philanthropists lined up to share their stories and expertise with you. So, grab yourself a beverage, sink back into a comfortable chair, and enjoy the next half an hour with me. Today's guest comes to us from Mozambique via Skype, where the internet connection wasn't that great. But nonetheless, we had a really cool conversation. I was talking to Larissa Sousa, who is the Associate Director for Educational Programs at Gorongosa National Park. Larissa is well-educated. She's been at Gorongosa since 2017, where she runs this wonderful educational program, having cut her teeth in Germany, where she worked for Daimler-Benz as the contact person for the Production Learning Systems Program, which was an international program between Germany and Brazil. She has a rich and very interesting education, having just completed her master's degree in business administration. So please join me, sit back and be enthralled with this wonderful lady and a wonderful story.
I am an employee of Gorongosa National Park, which Greg is the big boss, the philanthropist who actually is working with the government of Mozambique to restore the park. So the Gorongosa has a project, which is called Gorongosa Project, and it employs people, and we do different projects within the Gorongosa Project.
I met Greg Carr a couple of years ago over here in North America. He's got a home out in Idaho, and he had a very interesting gathering of people for about 3 days. He brought what looked like the entire Princeton University biology department to his to his place, and they were all in some way or shape or form working in Mozambique or on projects associated with the development of Gorongosa. And what I discovered at that time is they were kind of doing a biological profile of the entire ecology of the area, trying to figure out which species, be it fauna or flora, occurred there naturally and had been wiped out during those terrible years between the 70s and middle 90s.
Between that time, there was the civil war, and before it was the colonial war. So,
yeah, Mozambique's been it's been scarred by a lot of unrest over the years. I mean, you think about Mozambique's history, right? It goes back to the 4th, 5th century, where I suppose the early trading influences came out of the East or the Middle East, like the Arab traders down the Swahili coast.
Yes.
Now, are you a native Mozambican? Were you born and raised there?
Yes, I was born and raised in the central area of Mozambique.
Yeah, because I noticed your accent has got sort of almost an American twang. Where were you educated?
I did my primary and my secondary school here in Mozambique, and then I went to do my bachelor's degree in Finland. When I finished that, I came back and I did my master's degree in Zimbabwe, the neighboring country.
Fantastic. And in Finland, I mean, they obviously have an English medium education.
Yes, they do. I did study some Finnish, but it was just as a second language. All my schooling was in English.
Okay, but obviously your primary schooling would have been in Portuguese. Isn't that the national language of Mozambique?
Yes, it is. It was in Portuguese. But my parents always taught me English since I was small. So I got to practice along the years. And when I started my high school, I actually went in an English school so that I would be better prepared to go to university overseas.
So right now you speak English like a first language. You speak Portuguese as a first language. You know, a smattering of Finnish. And when you were studying in Zimbabwe, I gather that would have been in English as well.
Yes. And I speak a little bit of German also. I stayed about a year and a half there, and I was working and studying. I did an exchange program there, so I speak a bit of German as well.
Wow, that's remarkable. You're a linguist. And then I'm going to make a wild assumption that you have a native tongue as well.
Yes, I do. I do. In Mozambique, there is quite a lot of native languages, but the one in my area is Shitewe, and I do speak it.
So say that again, Shitewe.
Yes, Shitewe.
And is that spelled with an X, X-I-T-H-E-W-E?
Yes.
So is that in its origin similar to the Tsonga or the Shangaan spoken across the border in South Africa?
No, Shangaan is more to the southern part of Mozambique. Uh-huh. In the center, we speak Sena, which is more into the Sofala area. And then we have the Manika area, which is Shitewe, which is very similar actually to the native language in Zimbabwe, which is Shona.
Uh-huh.
So okay, the Manika land was a very long time ago, actually one whole territory. And the country is divided, the Manika side of Mozambique and the Manika side of Zimbabwe. So most of the languages are very much related and similar.
Okay, so I'm not looking at a map, but if I recall the sort of outline of the country of Mozambique, it's almost like a very long exclamation mark down the eastern coast of Africa. But it also has like a little fingerling that extends to the interland, almost making a Y or a V formation. And on the western side of that Y is the Tet province. And from there, you enter into Zimbabwe. Is that the area you're referring to as Manika land?
No, a bit lower. So where the west part in the Tet province that you're talking about, you go a bit lower.
Okay.
We also have a border right into Zimbabwe.
Okay, got you. And then obviously north of there, you've got the southern tip of Lake Malawi and Malawi on the western boundary. You know, I met a guy in Malawi a couple of years ago. His name was Jimmy, and he was a Greek surname. So I can't remember his surname, something like Kariannakis or Kariatakis. And he had a dream of turning a piece of land that he owned into a conservation project. Apparently there were some rhino that lived in the hills behind his property. And that eventually it connected into Mozambique. It was on the Mozambican border, but he was living on the eastern shore of Lake Malawi. And this was during the time of, I suppose, the civil war, Frelimo and Renamo days in Mozambique. And he was out fishing one day on the lake. And he unfortunately drifted a bit further than he should have and was eventually shot at by, I don't know, militiamen. Militiamen coming out of Mozambique. But his greatest It's a wonderful story, and I wish I could tell it completely, but he said he heard these gunshots and the bullets flying over his head, so he dived into his boat, into the foredeck of his boat, to try and get out of range. And the only thing that was left exposed was his bottom, his bum. And he actually... No, but it is, I mean, it's a sad story, but it's a funny story. He did get shot in the buttocks, and he eventually made it home. Obviously, he survived the ordeal, otherwise he wouldn't have told me the story, but he does walk with a pretty pronounced limp. So you then must have been a young child when all of that hot, heady stuff, violence was going on.
Yeah. I'm from the 90s, so.
Oh, okay. So you fortunately got there just as everything, well, I suppose, was coming to an end, fortunately.
Exactly.
But that meant that you were growing up in a sort of a war-torn Mozambique, an impoverished Mozambique, lots of poor people, infrastructure that had been destroyed and was needing to be rebuilt. So I'm mentioning this because I'm in admiration of you being this international student and phenomenal linguist, coming out of, I suppose, such adversity.
Yeah.
What were your parents up to when you were being raised?
Well, they had me when they were quite young, actually. And my mom was still finishing her training. My dad was at the moment working for an NGO called Concern. And they just been very hard workers. They are my inspiration and big examples, because with all that going on, they always had plans and big plans in terms of education for my sister and I. Even though we were not wealthy, but they always made big sacrifices to ensure that we had the best education that we could have. And I think everything is paying off. As education is a long-term investment, and I think they did the best, and it was amazing to see these young people being able to do all of these things and to accomplish what they've accomplished.
Well, you are very fortunate and very lucky, and I think in many more ways than what you've just said, because at that time, and I suppose still part of the social challenge in Mozambique today is the empowerment of women. And for your mum to have been progressing during those days is, I suppose, in itself quite progressive. What was she training to do?
Actually, my mom is trained as a radio and TV technician. Wow. That means she fixes TVs and radios, or most electronics. So when she finished that, she started working in Mozambique National Bank. So she worked there for a couple of years, and then she started working at Coca-Cola Company. And there she worked as a sales supervisor, and she just was growing from there. And I remember she then got promoted to the provincial sales supervisor, and she was one of the best at it, and I remember being very proud of her. And I saw her driving a truck one of those days. I think there was some problem with the driver, and she suddenly took the wheel for some reason. And people were like, "Oh, we saw your mom driving a truck." And at that time, it was so weird to see a woman driving a truck. So it was something very interesting and empowering for her and for me. To be able to see that and having people talk about that, you know.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, as they say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and clearly this is the case with you. But now, and I don't mean to harp on your mum, but I mean, that for me, it's relevant because it's shaped who you've become. How was she perceived in the community, being this sort of advanced woman in a society that kind of was chauvinistic or male dominated?
I think she was seen at the beginning as a pushy person and a bit arrogant, because she was trying to be in a very male world and doing things that women are not supposed to do, because she went from working in the bank just an office job, and that was what women are supposed to do, to going to Coca-Cola and doing all of these things and ending up driving a truck. So people are like, so who's this woman? Who's this person trying to show off, you know?
that's fantastic. Now, so then you learned from your mom. You obviously got your attitude from your mom in terms, and I'm talking saying attitude of courage and growth, the knowledge. The knowledge that an education is probably the greatest wealth that you can have has catapulted or propelled you into an environment now, which is, in my opinion, quite remarkable, to be involved in conservation, to be involved in developing a national park or restoring a national park to its former glory is a really heady goal. I've been so inspired by the whole process that this park has gone through. I'm actually fascinated by the connection between the park and the people. Now, just to give you a little bit of a background about me, I come from the wilderness background, which has a very simple philosophy, and that is we need to conserve and preserve our wilderness areas for posterity. And a wilderness area is defined by its absolute natural state. And so that's not to say that humans cannot interact with wilderness. The point is that that humans leave no trace. You go into the wilderness, you experience it, and you remove yourself without leaving a footprint, or maybe that's all you leave is a footprint. And so it's this kind of, you're kind of giving wilderness a sacrosanct status. It's precious. It's to be looked after in its absolute most natural, beautiful state. So shift that philosophy across now and come and look at Gorongosa, where there is a park that's been utterly destroyed by civil unrest, by people harvesting the wildlife for survival of their own. And it's become something of a wasteland in the 70s and 80s, and now you're restoring it. But what I'm seeing is a departure from the wilderness philosophy of this land is precious and it should not be impacted by humans. In fact, it's the contrary. This land is precious, but human impact on the land now is going to restore it to its former glory. And the glory of that park is going to be sustained because it can sustain humans. And this is where people like you have come into the conservation picture, which is not typical of, let's say, conservation over the last 100 years, where man's role was focused entirely on the ecosystem. Here, you're using the ecosystem to play a role in the development of your communities. So I'm very intrigued to know how you are doing this and what sort of people you're influencing to achieve your goals.
So what we do in Gorongosa is ensure that we help the community who lives around the park, not inside of the park. Inside of the park, it's prohibited for people to live inside. Unfortunately, there's still people living inside of the park from very long time ago during the war times, because in the park, it's where the resources are. So water and fertile soil. So people chose to come into the park and use these resources there. So now we're trying to work to remove these people to the boundaries of the park, where we call the buffer zone. And there we help the people to ensure that they are the main and the first advocates of the park. But the first thing is that these people are illiterate, so they haven't had any or much education. So they don't understand when we tell them that you need to save the park and not use the resources that are inside there. So I work on the human side of things, which is the human development department, where we ensure that the people have basic conditions. So if they have health services provided, that there is education services provided, and that they have other options or alternative livelihood activities that they can do, because before they were used to doing poaching and using all of these resources that I just mentioned that are in the park. So what we're trying to do is ensure that they have all of these conditions provided, as well as teaching them and ensuring that they know the importance of the park, because most of them don't know why we are preserving, why are we conserving, and making sure that this is, it stays as it is, as you said, that we just leave our footprints. We don't bring anything in, we don't take anything out, to make sure that they understand how valuable it is for them with tourism. If more people are able to come, they bring money that they're able to also gain from this. Because for every community that lives around the park, they get 20% of the profits that we get from the tourism that is done annually. So it's this continuous education, as well as ensuring that they are developing themselves, because these are very rural areas and a lot of things are neglected from them, and especially being Gorongosa, which is the center of the opposition party's bases. So a lot of things have been neglected for these people. So we're trying to ensure that they are somehow developed and they have these basic conditions to ensure that they now tell everyone else in the world how important it is to save this park, as well as conserving it as a whole.
That's absolutely fascinating. And the process I find quite intriguing, because if you look at many other African countries where a national park is involved, people were forced out of that national park area. There was no consideration given really to their livelihoods and or future. It was simply a case of, well, we're going to proclaim this hectarage as a national park, and therefore anybody who's within needs to get out, and we'll help you get out by moving you. So here I see, if I'm understanding what you've said correctly, you're creating incentives for people to migrate out of the park freely and freely and willingly, and I think that's a remarkable philosophy.
and it's been working quite a lot, so we're very happy to not having to force people to get out. And there's always big problems, and when you have to force people, and there's a whole other process when we have to move them as well.
So I mean, I'm just thinking about this. They've got to be quite excited at the prospect of being able to move and also receive services and social support, because, I mean, the alternative of staying in the park must be quite frightening, because they would have lived in an area that had been, laid waste, and predators like lions and leopards and dangerous animals like buffalo and elephant would have been eradicated from the area. So, in a sense, their communal lifestyles in the past years would have been somewhat free of anxiety. And now, with the restoration of Gorongosa, they've got a whole new system of things to be afraid of. I mean, they're now living in an area that has become populated with lions. It's had elephant reintroduced. The buffalo population, I'm sure, is growing. And these are, I suppose, for humans, potentially dangerous animals. So I think they should be quite excited at the options that are being put in front of them.
For going outside in the boundaries of the park, where they feel safer, they have all of these benefits, and so they really looking forward to move to the buffer zone, as we call it.
I heard that the lion population had basically gone from 7 to something like 100 and something. Do you know that number?
Yes. It's when we started, it was about 7 or less than 10, and now we have 100 plus, I think 110, and we just had recently cubs, so it keeps on growing.
That's fantastic. I mean, can you imagine, as a villager 10 years ago, you were living in this area that you'd kind of eaten to the soil. You were growing some rudimentary crops, maybe running a few goats. and you had no fear in the world. Now all of a sudden you venture out your front door and all of a sudden there's a lion staring you in the face along with the rest of its pride. I think that must be quite scary.
Yeah, that's very scary, and I'm sure nobody would like that.
Yeah, so they're happy to move out, well, or move out, not move out, move along. And I suppose being stakeholders in the park now receiving profits from tourism must be quite encouraging as well.
Of course. And they are able to, as a community, decide what is the best thing to use the money for. For a general benefit, as well as ensuring that there's other activities that they can do and get assistance from us. So they have quite a lot more benefits going out, actually.
Fantastic. Now, I've got a few questions for you on the subject of the community and the shareholding in the park. The park is quite large. Do you happen to know how many square kilometers or square miles it is at the moment?
It's 6,000. I would have to confirm that number, but okay. It's, hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Okay. It's 400,000 kilometers squared.
That's a really large piece of real estate. Now, there must be quite a few communities that surround that park. Do you have any idea of sort of population level? If you were to talk about a community, I assume we're talking about a village system. Do you know how many villages there are around the park?
So in Mozambique, there's different levels of areas. So we are working in 16 reguladus. So these are like big groups of communities, and in total we are working with about 103 communities, like small communities, which putting together these communities makes the 16 regulados where we're working with. But in each community we have a school, we have a community leader, for example, and they are the local authority which we work with normally. But there, as you said, there's many communities, and the total population around the buffer zone that we're working with is about 250,000 people.
That's incredible. I mean, that is a massive job that you've taken on. How do you split your time in getting to all those communities? It seems like you probably have got no time to spend on an interview with me. That's amazing.
Yes, I do have time now because I'm working from home, but before I wouldn't. we are quite a big team. As I said, we have different departments. We have science, conservation, human development, sustainable development. So each team has 80 plus people who actually have supervisors. So we just have quite a structured hierarchy where we try to ensure that we have an integrated approach, where we have people going to the communities. It's impossible to go to all of the communities at the same time, but what we try to do is ensure that each program has enough transport in terms of resources, that they also have one has access to, and we try that way to be able to integrate all our activities. So well, that everyone knows where each person is. And if I need, for example, to go to a community and I know that I don't have a car, but my colleague from another department is going there, then I join that team, and just things like that. And each month we have a monthly a plan, and people just try to work with each other in that sense.
So what do you have, a sort of a park headquarters where all aspects of the Gorongosa management team get together and figure out what they're going to do? Or do you meet outside somewhere in a town or a village in a communal area? How does that work?
Yeah, we have the headquarters. We actually live inside of the park in a camp called Shitengu.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have another one called CEC, Community Education Center. So that's where we have our offices. And most of the management people live and work from.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent. I wanted to just ask you about the complexities of the job. And in one of your profiles that I read, you're particularly involved in women's affairs. I think our listeners need to understand a little bit about the social structure of social structure of Mozambique, particularly in rural communities, how that works, because it's, I think, quite different to the way we see life in the Western world.
Especially in the rural areas, there's still a lot of tradition involved. So it's very closed in the sense that women are not as valued in terms of education. So the women in the community are not allowed to study as much. And so as soon as they're considered 30, they are sent to get married. And the husband is the one who can continue with education and to go and work and cater for the family, for example. But what we try to do is shift from that kind of thinking, but as well as respecting the traditions, of course. But we just want to share people for all the kids, both girl child and boy child, and ensure that we reduce the numbers of early marriages. And I think we've gone a long way and still are in terms of reduction of early marriages. So we're very happy about that. And the law is going on our side now in last August, actually. Yeah, so I was saying the law is now on our side. Last August, they criminalized early marriages. So that means that now people can go to jail for arranging an early marriage. So we're very happy about that, and it's been helping us quite a lot. And we've been doing a lot of trainings in the communities, because most of these people, they just been doing whatever their parents and grandparents have been doing. So they haven't actually thought and reasoned things. So now we're working a lot now with women in the communities, and as well as men, because they are the decision makers. And so it's been a long journey, and to empower women is to give them knowledge, to give them information. So that's what we're trying to do.
I know, and that's a really intriguing and a fine line that you're walking. I think back to some exposure that I had in a very rural area of Kenya, where the practice was the same, where women were married off at a young age, and they then became wives, mothers, and I suppose keepers of the manyata and the hard labor in and around that village. But for them, it was their future, and it gave them a security, and it gave them a life outside of their own parents' home, which was seen by them as progressive. So you're taking that a step further. In fact, not a step, strides, leaps and bounds beyond that. What typically is an early marriage? I mean, how young can a woman be or a girl be to be married?
Well, I think what they consider mature is when the child has a menstrual period, because that means that now she can have kids.
Right.
So as soon as that happens, and that can be from 11 years old, 13 years old, 14, 15. So it can be as early as 11 years old. And we actually seen a case of an 11-year-old girl, and it's just very hard for us to go into a community and speak to the parents, and they're like, oh, this is my child, I can do whatever I want with it.
Mm.
So it's very hard, but it's something that has to be done.
In these communities, do they ever practice what we know in Southern Africa as the Lobola system, where essentially the the groom's family pays some sort of dowry to the daughter's, the wife's family.
Father. Yeah, yes. And that's the other part that encourages parents to do, because then they don't have to cater for this girl child anymore and they get money for it. So it's like selling, actually.
Yeah, trading. And so who arranges the marriage? Is it predominantly the fathers that get together under a tree somewhere and discuss the value of their daughter?
Yes. Wow. Normally the male figure in the house goes and talks to normally the potential husband or the potential husband's family, and they arrange it all.
I mean, that sort of endorses the courageous work that you're doing, because not only are you trying to improve a social system, but you're also improving a social system against the protagonist of maintaining the original system.
Oh yes. It can be very hard at times, and you don't know what to do. You just want to scream, and yeah, it gets very hard sometimes. But it at the end of the day, you also feel a lot of reward when good things come out of it. So
yeah. Now you do you ever get threatened? I mean, if you're making these changes and you're bringing pressure to society where people's personal interests are at stake, sometimes they all feel threatened and want to try and retaliate. Have you come under any sort of social pressure from the communities to cease and desist and leave things as they are?
I don't think I've experienced something directly, but I've received a lot of comments, and different parents have been saying things in the community, and of course people come and tell us what's going on in the community when we're not there. And the male community members who are not so happy with the work we are doing, because they are now having to change their ways, having to adjust to this new reality. And most of what they say is, who are these people coming into our communities and telling us what we are supposed to do, and who's this Larissa, and you know, these kind of things. But we always tell them that, hey, we are not scared. If you have something to tell us in our faces. So everyone's just quiet when we are there.
Oh, well, power to you. Congratulations on achieving that. I'm amazed. I'm absolutely amazed that you're able to basically move these big boulders uphill. One quick question for you on the marriage system. Is it a polygamous society?
Yes, it is.
And is there a limit to the amount of wives that a man can take, or is that dictated by the amount of money he's got to pay?
Yeah, that's normally dictated by the money that he has, or the land, or whichever resources he has that encourages more wives for him to have more wives. But normally it's the amount of money he has.
Wow. Now, help me just to get a visual of what a typical village would be like, where you might find these types of communities living. And I'm not, when I say type, I'm just talking about that rural village. Is it grass and mud, or have they moved from that now into sophisticated brick and mortar?
No, very, very basic. Grass and mud, and they have no electricity. Some are starting to get solar panels. Some communities starting to have cell phones, so they need some kind of electricity, so they get solar panels. But most are still very rural, very poor. And I wouldn't say they live under $1 or $2 per day, but they very, very basic still. And it doesn't seem like they want to change or upgrade. So when we now introduce this development, and hey, you can work to get money to improve your lifestyle, that's when they now starting to think and envision things.
Mm, So they're essentially transitioning from a subsistence lifestyle where they would possibly have some kitchen crops and a handful of goats, maybe cattle, to feed them. Is that a typical scene?
Yes, they're very basic, and they're used to just doing subsistence and living day by day. So for them is when we talk about development and changing from grass and mud to bricks, they still like, why should I? So it's we're still in that process.
Well, I suppose it must be really difficult for you to be able to describe or create a vision for them, because things that we have access to without even thinking about it today. I mean, the mere fact that we're talking over Skype is an ability to learn from each other. We have cellular technology where we can interact and even trade on our phones. We have access to televisions, radios, the internet service where we can find all sorts of information. How we choose to use that information is up to us. But we're talking about a community here that doesn't have electricity, so therefore anything that needs power is unavailable. They have no idea really what's going on in the Western world. How do you go about painting this picture of the future, and telling them or showing them that their traditional ways are becoming essentially history, and that progress is now this developing infrastructure, this need to transact with currency, and to trade their labor for money. How are you managing to get that message across?
I think it has to be step by step, and just like how it happened with us, that it didn't come all at once. So it's just trying to show them. We now helping to build schools, brick and cement schools, very nice looking schools in these communities, so we can show them like, hey, you can someday build a house like this, which when a cyclone comes, which we had last year, it won't get destroyed. And using real examples that they can see and they can understand. Most of the communities now are starting to use the phone, for example. So by we using examples that they see, that they know it's easier, and I think it's working.
Now, okay, so there's that saying, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So you can build a school.
True.
How do you get the children to get to school? How do you get them to come and study and learn and be part of it?
Well, even in the very basic mud schools that they were studying in, they would go from home there. So it's not something that we have to change there. We can improve someday in the far future that we can maybe try and provide transport for them. But at the moment, it's these schools are located in the exact same place. So they would go to a just improved school that is made out of bricks and cement, and they can sit on a proper school desk, that they have actual books and just improve things, but that they are in the same routine that they were.
Okay, so it's not an entirely new concept, the concept of education. There's growth there, but surely there must be
No,
some there must be some
that
community.
was already there, so we were just improving.
Those original school systems, I mean, they obviously were driven by the community. Were they in any way funded by the government or supported by the government?
Yes, these are all government supported schools, and they actually run it. We don't run the schools. We just help with infrastructure. We help with equipment, the school desks, but the whole actual system is all government run.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And I mean, I suppose quite challenging for the government to be accepted in that part, because as you mentioned early on, this area of Mozambique is typically the center of the opposition to the government, or was for many years. How's that political scene changed over the last decade?
It has improved, not much, but 2015 and 16 were very bad years. We had a lot of attacks and it was a war zone. But 17 to now, it has calmed down, but it's still not as safe as it was before. And with elections, we had elections last year. It was a bit crazy also, but now it seems that it's a bit calm. Since December of last year, the situation is much better. But it's always this rise and fall of events, and you never know what to expect, actually. And the president of the Renamo party, Soja Kama, passed away 2 years ago. Yes. And so we've seen the party, there's a lot of confusion as well. So the actual new president now is somehow not in accordance with what the people who are the militants who are in Ngorongoza's base. So it's a bit tricky. We don't really know what's going on, actually.
But it's sort of simmering down. It's becoming the incidents and the agitation and the aggression is becoming less and less as each month goes by. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, there is. That is correct. And well, it seems that the attention is more into Cabo Delgado lately.
Yeah, that's up in the north, right?
Yes, right in the north with the border with Tanzania.
Yeah, I read about, I've been following the slow development up there of the last, I suppose, 2 to 3 years, where this, yeah. I think it's technically is an offshoot of Al-Shabaab, have slowly been closing in and establishing a dominance in those northern towns. And coincidentally, this last series of incidents coincides with the discovery of natural gas, or the exposure of the discovery of natural gas, which makes one wonder exactly what the motives are.
Yeah, there's been so many conspiracy theories around that. But as you said, it was too much coincidence happening at the same time, the discovery of natural gas and other minerals. Actually, there's a lot of minerals up there, and all of this chaos started when that was found out.
Yeah. Well, I put the stability or the stabilizing of the national park area down to the economic benefits that Ngorongosa mm-hmm. National Park has been providing for those communities, and I firmly believe that as that park becomes more popular with tourists and it starts attracting, you know, people to come and visit, leaving some money behind after they've been, that will filter down into the communities and people will suddenly realize the sort of capitalist value of the park. And I suppose once you've got a full belly and a happy community, there's no more need for violence. There's no need for the aggression. It will dissipate. I'm sure these old Renamo guys are the older people from the war rather than
generation. Yes, they are.
Yeah, well, that's positive news. Now, Mount Ngorongosa has been incorporated into the park to obviously be reforested with natural and indigenous forest. It seems to me that growing coffee within the park now is kind of a conflict of interest to the park, which is a natural biome. Is this seen as a long-term project or an intermediary project? Or is it something that is being worked into that balance of, you know what, human interactivity with the modern style of running a national park?
Yeah, I think it's more of what you just mentioned, the balance between are we working with the community and the development as well as the reforestation there up in the mountain, because the idea is not to touch much of what is in the wilderness, but at the same time we needed to do reforestation up there, so that's what we're doing. And I think for now it's still an ongoing project to continue doing the coffee, but we are now moving a lot into giving the seedlings into to the farmers, and they do it outside, so in the buffer zone, not on inside of the park.
Okay, so I mean, is there a section of that mountain then that occurs outside the park where they can have access to that altitude that is critical for growing coffee, or will they be growing this? Okay, understood. That makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, Larissa, I think it's been fantastic chatting to you. You've highlighted quite a few things that I think the world is going to find intriguing, not only about yourself, but about the community that you're working with, about Gorongosa, the project. I think it's a shining example of how for conservation in this modern or this new millennium to succeed, people have got to change attitudes, shift paradigms, and become more interactive for these parks to be self-sustaining, which is critically important to the longevity of those parks and the future of our great-grandchildren. Where do you see yourself in closing, by the way? Where do you see yourself in the next decade to two?
Ooh, I see myself getting older. I'm not a big 30-year or 10-year plan person, but in the next 5 years, I still see myself in the park, working to empower women. And I also hope that by then we have a lot more improvements, that we have fewer of or less in less how can I say less input from us, and more sustainability for the communities. I think it takes a long time for people to have behavior change, but at the same time I think the little things will then make for a bigger impact in the future. So I think that we still need to be there for a bit longer. But I hope then in the next 10 years, they will be more sustainable, that will be more developed, and that they have a more open world for them.
Well, fantastic. While you might consider yourself as getting older, I seem to think of myself as remaining 18, but that's a joke that I have with my family.
Very nice.
All I can say to you is Africa is a very big continent. Mozambique is a very big country. And while you are essentially involved in a very small portion of it right now, the impact that you're having by all reports is large, exemplary. And I think we should watch you, because I think your influence is going to range way further than the shores of Mozambique. We need more people like you. We need you to replicate yourself. And I think you can have a greater influence over the continent of Africa, where women are certainly suppressed and are needing a leader and an advocate. And of course, the balancing of that along with the conservation aspects makes for Africa a much richer continent, and I think that you're going to become a great leader in this wonderful field. So thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you Warren.
I'm sure we will be talking again. Thanks, Larissa.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your patience, and sorry about this horrible internet issue.
No problem. 50-50. It might have been half on my side and half on your side. I am only living in the United States.
I feel much better now. Thank you.
Okay, Larissa. Bye-bye.
Take care, Arvin. Bye.